Good morning. It's Thursday, the 2nd of May, and this is Govinda Jethiraj broadcasting and streaming from and headquartered in Mumbai, India's financial capital. Our top stories and themes for today. Indian markets are balancing strong domestic economic indicators and weak global cues. India's April numbers for GST or goods and service tax hit a record high, over 2 lakh crore rupees now. Oil prices are in a steep fall now, back to $85 a barrel. The Godrej Group splits up amicably. Early preparation may have helped. Understanding redistribution of taxes in India and the country's balance sheet. How more Indians are watching movies in cinema halls than ever before. And international air cargo grows in double digits for the fourth consecutive month.
This is a Core Report with Govindraj Ethiraj.
The markets await global cues and balance strong domestic numbers. The stock markets on Tuesday slipped back after a solid run on Monday. Wednesday, that is yesterday, was a markets holiday, being May 1st and Maharashtra Day. The markets are still running on sound momentum, and a little more on that in a bit. But there is some underlying nervousness that's creeping in, which is expected till the results of the general election are announced on June 4th. Remember, the markets have fully priced in a substantive win for the current government. On Tuesday, the BSE Sensex was down 188 points to close at 74,483, and the Nifty 50 was down 39 points to close at 22,605. Wall Street was weak on Tuesday too, bringing to an end a negative month as a whole. All major indices dropped between 1.5 and 2% on Tuesday. That's on Wall Street. The Dow lost 5% for its worst monthly performance since September 22, said CNBC. And other indices also lost similarly, with the three major averages snapping a five-month winning streak. On Wednesday, the markets were mixed to weak, depending on which index you looked at, as they awaited a Fed signal on interest rates, which would be a continuation on status quo or off status quo, which is, of course, no change in interest rates or the much-awaited reduction. Oil prices slide sharply. We discussed this on the Core Report the other day. Oil prices are tending to slide the moment external pressure points like war risk premiums ease off, edging closer or towards $80 a barrel than the $90 a barrel, which of course it's been kissing and worries everyone. For the Indian stock markets, by the way, it's the other way around at this point. The default trend is still positive and stocks are rising and get held back for a variety of reasons ranging from domestic earnings to international interest rates. And then there is political continuity, which the stock markets have gone all in on. Back in oil, it slipped further with indicators of a rise in US crude inventories. Benchmark crude fell below $85 a barrel for the first time since the middle of March, and West Texas Intermediate, or WTI, was at, or rather below, $81 a barrel. Bloomberg said that US crude stockpiles increased by about 5 million barrels last week, according to the American Petroleum Institute, and this would be the fifth expansion in 6 weeks if confirmed by official data later. Oil traders are, like everyone, watching closely to see if there will be a ceasefire in the Middle East. India was not the only market shut on Wednesday, and May 1st Labor Day holidays were observed in several countries, which also means that overall trading volumes, including in commodities like oil, is lower, something we also see during holiday shortened weeks and long weekends. Elsewhere, gold and silver prices are down too. Gold is now in the roughly 71,000 per 10 gram range for 24 karat gold, that's rupees, which is at least 3,000 rupees or so below its recent peaks. Goods and service tax collections are up and at new records. India's goods and service tax collection, or indirect tax collections, hit a record high in April 2024 at 2.1 lakh crore rupees, or 210,000 crore rupees. Now, this is a 12.4% year-on-year growth thanks to a jump in domestic transactions around 13% and imports, or collection of duty on them, which was up about 8%. GST collections for April have traditionally been higher. The previous high was hit on April 2023 as it reflects trade and economic activity for March, which is high, which is also the last month of the financial year. After accounting for refunds, net GST revenue for April 2024 was at about 1.92 lakh crore rupees, which is up about 15% compared to the same period last year, according to the government. Last April, GST collections figures were at about 1.87 lakh crore rupees, or 187,000 crores. Monthly GST collections have been rising steadily since GST was introduced in July 2017, so that's about 7 years ago. It used to average under about 1 lakh crore rupees per month in 17-18, that was the first year. Collections have been rising fast after that, particularly after the pandemic period of 2020 to 2022, and now to average about 1.5 lakh crore in 22-23. Gross collections in the first month of 24-25, that's the current financial year, were also up about 18% compared to March, that was 1.78 lakh crore rupees. States like UP, Punjab and Delhi have reported stronger growth, a report from Money Control said. Meanwhile, amongst other economic indicator figures, which might also act as a positive trigger for the market, the IMF has raised India's 23-24 GDP growth forecast projection to 7.8%, which, as it happens, is higher than the government's projection. The IMF report said that India and the Philippines have been the source of repeated positive growth surprises, supported by resilient domestic demand. A surprise exit at Kotak Bank. The timing is not looking very good. Weeks after the Reserve Bank of India asked Kotak Bank to halt issuing new credit cards and onboarding new customers through its online portal and mobile app, a top bank official has stepped down. KVS Manian, Joint Managing Director at the bank, that's Kotak Mahindra Bank, has resigned with immediate effect, according to an exchange filing from the bank on the 30th of April. Manian, who's an almost three-decade-old Kotak Bank veteran and whose tenure predates the formation of the bank and from the non-bank finance company days, was also a front-runner for the CEO's position in the transition that happened from founder Uday Kotak to new CEO Ashok Vaswani, who took over on the 1st of January this year. In his resignation to the bank, Manian said he was resigning to pursue other opportunities in financial services and thus was stepping down from the board as well. So, veterans like Manian, who occupy top positions in many of the private banks, are undoubtedly being sounded out for leadership roles in smaller private banks and maybe some of the larger non-bank finance companies as well. Many would have and are also considering fintech startups, though that allure may not be as strong today as it was maybe even a year ago. However, it is quite clear on a somewhat different note that while experience could be replaced somewhat with technology in a technology-driven banking ecosystem, it is abundantly clear that integrity cannot. And that is the facet the Reserve Bank is repeatedly exposed as lacking in many of its actions and crackdowns recently. The Godrej Group splits up amicably. Early preparation may have helped. Roughly two decades ago, in an interview on family-run businesses, among other things, Adi Godrej, who was then chairman of the Godrej Group, enlightened me on the existence of family councils in their group, where family members also involved in business met periodically and thrashed out issues of mutual and business importance. The reason, he told me, was that issues including disputes were bound to arise over time and fester, and the family council with its elders was the best place to voice them and find resolution to the satisfaction of everyone. Now, looking around, there are cases where the family councils have worked, like evidently in the Godrej Group, where an asset and responsibility split has become formalized, and elsewhere where it has not. The existence of family councils, some business owners may use other terms, is in itself not a solution to all problems that may arise, including obviously ambition and desire on the part of a family member to rise beyond the rest or break away. But it does appear that family councils seem to serve their purpose, at least going by the number of instances which do not happen. So their existence and effective functioning is also important to the outside world, particularly when there are so many listed companies, shareholders and stakeholders involved. One of the biggest failures in this direction is obviously the events that led to the public and acrimonious split of the Ambani brothers, Anil and Mukesh, in 2005, following their father's untimely demise 3 years earlier, which obviously put other family business owners on notice or alert since. In what is now being termed as one of the most amicable business carve-ups or splits, the Mumbai-headquartered Godrej family is splitting up. Godrej Industries will stay with Adi Godrej and brother Nadir Godrej, with five listed companies, including the well-known Godrej Soaps and Godrej Agrovet. Cousins Jamshed Godrej and Smita Godrej will get the unlisted entities, including Godrej and Boyce, its affiliates, as well as a large land bank in Mumbai. The Godrej brand needs little introduction, of course, except to quickly sum up that it goes back 125 years to 1897 and was founded by Ardeshir Godrej. And then locks. Ardeshir launched the Anchor branded lock in 1897 to the springless lock in 1907 to the famous Navtal lock, which you may have seen in 1954. Some of Godrej's locks today cost a fortune almost and are quite naturally also devices capable of connecting to phones, internet, and what have you. Godrej as a group is also into a host of products, from locks, of course, which we talked about, to soaps, real estate, white goods, office furniture, and critical machinery and components for India's space and satellite launch efforts. So while the Godrej split is amicable, and it could also be to do with the general temperament of the senior family members of the business, it's equally likely that the efforts to address and then work out a split began a long time ago in keeping in mind and focus on shareholders and shareholder interest. How does redistribution of taxes work? Of course, our taxes get redistributed. But in the light of much discussion around this theme right now, it's instructive to revisit some basics. Not because there is a specific promise to redistribute more of our hard-earned taxes or collect more taxes through various devilish means, but because it's useful to know where we stand at this point. I reached out to Shankar Iyer, veteran economic journalist and author who's written extensively on the subject of tax collections, and then of course where they go, and who also in a recent column argued that redistribution is visible on India's balance sheet in schemes and provisions of private goods. So I began by asking him how he was looking at the theme of redistribution.
So when we look at redistribution, what we're actually talking about is inequality in sections of society, and this inequality stems from asymmetry or gaps in ability and in opportunity. Ability would be education, digital divide, skills and stuff. And opportunity would be, you might be in a state which doesn't have the kind of jobs that you want or you're trained for, or you might be, say, in Bihar where there's hardly any industry, or you know, you might be in Uttar Pradesh where it's still sort of wild west. So in that sense, what governments try to do is to empower the people who are in those kind of situations with schemes, programs, direct transfers and stuff. There is this general belief in India that we don't have redistribution. So India stopped taxing wealth, which is called in technical terms the stock, but it taxes income. So you have a surcharge on high-income people. We collect a little over 1.5 trillion rupees on that. So that money, how does it get used? It gets used for redistribution. We have to disabuse ourselves of this notion that there is no distribution happening. So if the government of India is spending money to provide free ration to 800 million people, that is somewhere distribution of money from taxes collected from those who pay to pay for free ration. The government of India has an insurance for health for people where it covers 500 million people. That's against distribution. Then you have provision of private goods, gas cylinders, homes, toilets, stuff like that. And then there is a direct benefit transfer to women and to farmers. So there is distribution happening. The only difference is that India doesn't target wealth. It sort of uses the collection of the government of India to pay for bridging the gap between the haves and have-nots. To give you a number, the centrally sponsored schemes India spent this year would be about 5 trillion rupees. It's not a small sum. I mean, if you look at the government of India balance sheet, we sort of spend 13,000 crores per day, earn about 8,000 crores per day, and borrow the rest. So we are borrowing to pay for some of this distribution.
Right. So you're saying the only distinction is the stock versus the flow. Obviously, India focuses on the flow, as do many other countries. And a few countries, of course, focus on the stock, which is the wealth. And therefore, the whole discussion on wealth taxes and inheritance taxes, which has not quite worked in India in the past.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've tried wealth and inheritance tax. We have tried demonetization. We've tried a whole lot of things, and those things haven't quite worked. It's also one thing that we must record is that the economy and people in the economy should have wealth to be taxed. It's not a very, I mean, you know, at 2,500 rupees per capita income, you're not a very wealthy individual. You're in the low middle income, not even the high income. So there are questions. I mean, what do you tax when there is no wealth? No, how many people pay income tax in India? How many people have their own homes? So those are things that one needs to look at. The general principle is that first attempt should be to improve, fix the policy gaps that cause inequality, which is primary education. I mean, you know, we have nearly 45% of the population dependent on agriculture, and which sort of they're living on 1/6 the national income. You have a great gap in provision of healthcare and education across the country. It's a very unlevel area. So when you look at the economy per se, first you have to fix the policy problems. And those policy interventions, hopefully, will provide growth. And out of growth, there will be people who will create wealth, and there will be people who will have incomes. Without growth, you will only redistribute poverty.
Right. Okay. So I think what you're saying mathematically also makes sense. But if there was a gap in redistribution in a country like India, what would it be?
You have to look at the political geography of India. So there are states. I mean, so if you look at Telangana has the highest per capita income, it's somewhere around 3 lakh rupees. Bihar is somewhere near 54,000 rupees. Uttar Pradesh is somewhere near 80,000 rupees. There is a district in Bihar, Shivar, which has 18,000 rupees per capita income. I mean, so the variation, the divergences are all different, and there are different causes for it. Obviously, in Bihar, it's a lack of industrialization, lack of education, lack of skilling, lack of economic activity. And if the south of India has higher per capita income, those are because those states worked on the education, worked on the industrialization. I mean, Tamil Nadu is now competing with Vietnam for projects. Almost all the new projects that have come in the last few years under PLI, including iPhone and others, have all gone to Tamil Nadu. There is a reason for that.
Right. So we are pretty highly taxed already, at least on the income tax side. Whatever additional growth in government revenues will obviously come from, let's say, economic growth itself, not people paying more taxes from their existing incomes or current incomes. So are you seeing any way out of that?
Well, what you define as resources depends both on what you earn and what you save. Does the government of India save adequately? That is a question. So you're building all these roads and all the infrastructure. There was a plan to have asset monetization. Did they do it? Where is it stuck? I mean, you know, why is it going forward? The public sector companies own large stocks of land. There was a plan to have a land bank and monetize that. Should the government of India be owning all that it owns? Should it be running all that it runs, including hotels and condom companies? Those are the questions. I mean, you might raise resources elsewhere. So the question is, how do you manage the ebbs and flows of economic growth in what you have in reserve? So the question, not just about taxation, I might say that, you know, service tax under GST in India on individuals is almost extortionate. There is no offset for a person. I mean, we talk about job creators, and then we go and tax them 18%. I mean, when education, the GST is 18%. I mean, what's the explanation for this? So we are a highly taxed system, and we are skewed in many taxes. We tax different assets differently for no rhyme or reason. So these things have to be corrected. Also, the large farmers, agriculturists, they're out of the tax bracket because the government of India can't tax them. The state governments have to tax them. But farmers have large constituencies, but they're never going to get taxed.
Right. Shankar, I think these are important points. And some of those, including on public sector units and land banks of the government, you've written about and consistently write about. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bhavit.
Indians are returning to movie halls. More than 157 million watched at least one film in the theater in 2023. Significantly, this trend-reversing figure is an 8% growth from the pre-pandemic number, that's Jan to March 2020, of 146 million. So these 157 million people bought 943 million tickets, which means they saw an average of six films in the year. Different languages did differently. Average viewership was highest in Telugu at 9 films, followed by Tamil at 8 and Hindi at 3. All this is part of Sizing the Cinema 2024, a report from Mumbai-based analytics firms Ormax Media, which is in its third year of publication and based on research, this time conducted in January amongst 8,500 people across urban and rural India. So I reached out to Sanket Kulkarni, Head Business Development Theatrical at Ormax Media, and I began by asking him what stood out most in these latest numbers.
Before I delve into that, Govind, the last time we spoke, it was for the Ormax Box Office 2023 report. So you know 2023 was phenomenal when it comes to box office, 12,000 crore plus. The recently launched Sizing the Cinema 2024 report is actually a market sizing report that quantifies the total number of theater goers in the country and then looks at it by language, state, demographics, so on and so forth. Now, 15.7 crore is the total number of audiences that saw film in 2023. This is a 29% growth over 2022 number and an 8% growth over the pre-pandemic number, as you just mentioned. Now, a major chunk of this growth comes predominantly because of Hindi. So you can say that Hindi has returned to form. Hindi has seen the most growth, which is almost a 50% growth in terms of its theater goers. The number for Hindi has grown from 5.8 crores in 2022 to 9.2 crores in 2023. It's 58% growth. Yeah, more than double. So now, interestingly, we touched upon this a little bit last time, but we were still waiting for the theater goers data to come in, which has again validated that. In 2022, right after the pandemic, there was very limited clarity in terms of what is working in the theaters, what kind of content to make, because there was the rise of OTTs happening. The theaters were shut down just before that. However, through Pathaan, Jawan, Animal and Gadar 2, the definition of what kind of works in the theater or what you call as a theatrical worthiness is something that Hindi market or Hindi industry has managed to kind of get a sense of. And I think that is the biggest win for 2023. So this whole inertia, which was there amongst audiences to go into the theaters, I think that has reduced. And so audiences are now open to walk into the theaters if there is a strong differentiated reason of why to watch this in the theater. So for Jawan, it would be Jawan or Pathaan, it would be SRK coming back in an action avatar. Or for Gadar, it would be nostalgia, so on and so forth. So I think that is single-handedly a very important reason that has been cracked, which has worked.
Is this also telling us that there was no secular downtrend in terms of people going away from movie halls and, you know, taking like a call, oh, I'm never going to go for a movie again. I mean, not even if I don't say it loudly, I may still never sort of, I stopped going to movies, let's say 2019, and then I've never gone back. But what this is telling us is that there was never any, you know, secular shift in the way people were viewing films or consuming entertainment content.
Yeah, I think what you're hinting at, and if I've got it correct, post the pandemic, right, theaters were closed. You have the rise of OTTs. If I have to just give you an idea, right from Jan 2021 till now, there would have been at least 600 plus titles that have launched, right? So you hadn't seen a boom like this in a while. So I think both from an industry perspective and an audience perspective, a lot of variables had to settle down to one to kind of figure out what content is meant for what medium. Right. And I think 2023, where you got that clarity really well as to what kind of content will kind of work in theaters, what kind of content will work on OTT and what kind of content. So I think even there's been a huge shift in terms of how audiences and their expectations have changed from content and the medium per se. So I think 2023, where this expectation kind of really stabilized. Yeah.
And therefore, they've come back to the movie halls because now they're very clear about what they want to see. And right. So, and that clarity was not there. So now when you say that there were 157 million Indians who watched one film in 2023, is that the highest ever?
Total number of audiences watching film in the theater. We've been doing this sizing study, unfortunately, only for the last 3 years. So I wouldn't have benchmarks before that. But yeah, in the last 3 years, it's highest. But to be really frank, the only closest competition would be maybe 2019, which had the highest theatrical footfalls. But I think it'll be highest, yeah.
Industry as a whole relies substantially, though not entirely, on theatrical for its survival and nourishment and so on. So what's the health of the industry looking like at this point?
So to be really frank, 2023, we saw from a box office perspective, was a very robust year for sure. Total number of unique audiences walking into theaters is definitely a very strong metric to look at. So even if that metric has grown, it's a very good sign. But interestingly, 15.7 crores is just 11.1% of our population, right? So the bigger question still remains. So for a country like USA, 70% of the population watches films in the theater, even today. For a country like Europe, it would be somewhere around 50% plus. So there's a long distance to cover when it comes to theatrical penetration at an overall level. Also, another interesting metric to look at from an industry health perspective would be theatrical footfalls, right? Now, Sizing the Cinema report talks about unique audiences who saw films in the theater. Theatrical footfalls would be total number of tickets sold, right? Now, interestingly, compared to pre-pandemic, unique theater goers has increased by 8%. But the theatrical footfalls have actually dropped by 8%. What it kind of tells you is, although you've got more unique people walking into theaters, the frequency of them watching films in the theater has not increased yet. And I think Hindi has a long distance to cover on this one, because as we were briefly discussing, the average number of films seen by a Hindi audience in the theater is 3. The same number for a Telugu and Tamil audience is almost 9.2 and 8.1. So that content stickiness of giving enough instances to walk into the theater again and again in the year is something that has a great scope of improvement.
So, okay. So which means that if there was more interesting Hindi content, which is of course a very generic term, people would come back like they are in the case of Tamil and Telugu.
There's scope to grow for sure. I understand like the difference between 3 and 9.2 kind of seems huge, but one has to also look at the other metrics or variables in place, right? For example, when you say a Hindi film industry, you're actually catering to such a huge diaspora. So there's a lot of heterogeneity per se. But when you talk about Tamil as an industry, it predominantly is making it for that one state. So there's a lot of homogeneity there. So
overall sense, the total revenue as I'm seeing is about 20,000 crores, 19,700. For that's for theatrical, music, TV and streaming. And theatrical is about 12,000.
Yeah, 12,226 crores is what that number was, yeah.
Is that split changing? I mean, what are the trends within that, within this 20,000 crores?
Within this 20,000 crores? I might have to check that, Govind, to be really frank. I genuinely see that theatrical may not get an exponential rise per se as of now, at least basis what the lineup of films you are seeing at least for this year. I think if I'm correct, you have a Pushpa, you have Singham again, and then you have Bhool Bhulaiya, Hera Feri and one more franchise. So the levels that, like, I don't think you have a Shah Rukh film this year again. And Shah Rukh had two films last year, which is Jawan and Pathaan. So from that perspective, beating this number is going to be slightly difficult. So I don't think that absolute number of 12,000 crores seems to be changing a lot per se.
How are you seeing footfalls in theaters compared to the consumption numbers across other medium, including internet and digital?
I still think that theatrical growth would be comparatively slower compared to other platforms, because unlike internet, which will get driven through a device or something, one of the biggest reasons I think we're not able to penetrate theatrically is also the whole unit of distribution and theaters, right? Like, just to give you an idea, in India, there are around, this is 2022 data, but there are around 7 screens per 1 million people that you have. The same number for China is 30. And the same number for UK and US is 68 and 125. So I think there's a lot of room of growth there. And one of the things that keeps happening is we also have the split of single screen type of theaters and multiplex theater, right? So till the Jawans, Pathans, Animals and the Gadars had not come, in the last 3-4 years, a major chunk of single screens had actually shut down, right? Now with this, films working, and one has to also understand that single screens will only support a certain type of content. Right. So you need to have makers who will make that kind of content. You need to have budgets that will support that kind of content. So I think the whole ecosystem needs to kind of amp up, which is getting a certain trajectory by now. But compared to digital and all, I definitely think this is going to be slow.
Sanket, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Govind. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Air passenger and cargo growth strong. Total demand measured in what is known as revenue passenger kilometers or RPKs was up close to 14% for March 2024 compared to 2023, according to latest figures from the International Air Transport Association or IATA. Total capacity measured in available seat kilometers was up about 12% year on year, and the March load factor was at about 82%, slightly over March 2023. IATA officials said the demand for travel is strong and there is every indication that this should continue into the peak northern summer travel season. So I guess that means if you haven't booked your tickets already for travel, then go ahead and do it now. Asia Pacific Airlines, and this is more important for us, continue to lead the way with an almost 38% year-on-year increase in demand, with capacity increasing about 37%. Major routes from Asia Pacific were growing very strongly, although the number of scheduled air services from China to North America is still only at 16% of pre-pandemic levels. Elsewhere, air cargo also continues to grow, rising 10% in March, making it the fourth consecutive month of double-digit year-on-year growth, according to IATA, which was also higher than the strong first quarter of 2021 performance during COVID. At the time, if you may recall, there was a lot of critical equipment and medicines that were being ferried using air transport. IATA's top official said that the figures were a reflection of global cross-border trade and industrial production continuing to grow, and that 2024 was shaping up to be a solid year for air cargo. That was the Core Report with me, Govindraj Ethiraj. Do stay connected with more of our coverage at The Core. You can check out our website or sign up to our newsletter for our exclusive stories, one in-depth feature a day on www.thecore.in. Do also track us on LinkedIn, where we usually post synopses or extracts of our top stories and interviews. We would love your feedback on how we can make business more interesting and relevant, including, of course, India's vibrant manufacturing sector. So write to us at feedback@thecore.in. And thank you once again for listening.